Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Remember the nuclear power renaissance? It just died. Westinghouse Electric, the maker of a new design that was supposed to lead the future, has filed for bankruptcy. The multi-billion dollar cost overruns for nuclear plants now under construction in Georgia and South Carolina may probably be paid by the taxpayers again. Is it finally the end of this dangerous scam? Joining us now is Tim Judson, the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, right near Washington, D.C. Tim, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I appreciate you having me.
Okay, Westinghouse Electric. It's a household name and a legend in establishing the grid. Now it's going under. Who owns it?
Toshiba actually bought Westinghouse about 10 or 11 years ago. So, you know, while Westinghouse has always been thought of as an American brand and, you know, a lot of their nuclear operations are still headquartered here in the U.S., you know, they're actually owned by a Japanese corporation at this point.
The people promoting nuclear power, including Dr. James Hansen, always say, just wait for the new Westinghouse AP1000 reactors. They will be much safer. What did the company claim was better about this design?
Well, they claimed that there were a number of advantages both to safety and to economics of these plants. And in terms of safety, they were developing a design that incorporated improvements in safety regulations that happened, you know, in the 1980s after the Three Mile Island and Chernobyl accidents that, you know, involved shifting from a reliance on safety systems that involved a lot of, you know, active mechanics, you know, like pumps and electrical systems, to having some more passive systems that could run when there was no power to the reactor, like a gravity-fed emergency coolant system and that sort of thing. But what we saw happen, among the things that we saw happen, were that after the Fukushima accident started in 2011, that, you know, again, you know, the regulators had to go back and revise their safety standards. And so there were some additional changes that needed to be made to the designs. And, you know, nuclear safety is always a moving target because for some reason, the accidents that continue to happen end up superseding what the industry thought was, you know, was adequate safety standards before.
It's always like planning for the last war, and then we get new surprises. So where are these new Westinghouse reactors being built?
So there are four being built in China, and there are four being built in the U.S. You know, there's eight under construction. They're all behind schedule and over budget. The Chinese reactors are, they're believed to be finished and coming online later this year and next year. But the ones in Georgia and South Carolina are all at least 3 to 4 years behind schedule now, and more delays could be coming. The first of those reactors in Georgia and South Carolina were supposed to come online in 2016 originally, having been ordered in 2008. And now the first of those reactors isn't likely to come online, even if their revised schedules are held to, until late 2019. And it's quite possible that that some of those reactors could still end up being canceled and their schedules pushed back until the 2020.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, with this bankruptcy, can we be certain the reactors already begun in the U.S. Southeast will be completed and become operational?
There's no guarantee at all of it. In fact, in the last week, both regulators in both Georgia and South Carolina have for the first time indicated that some of these reactors may not actually be completed. The Westinghouse bankruptcy has thrown the entire completion of those projects into question because, you know, one of the things that's driven Westinghouse into bankruptcy is that the cost overruns and the schedule delays in building these reactors have had to be partly borne by Westinghouse. And while Westinghouse has said that it's committed to finishing the projects that it started, there's no guarantee that, in fact, they're going to be able to absorb, you know, additional costs that are likely to come up in trying to get that job done.
Toshiba is a gigantic Japanese electronics company. Tim, why don't they bail out their own nuclear subsidiary?
Well, there's a question of the amount of debt that Westinghouse has gotten into and whether Toshiba could adequately absorb that. You know, Westinghouse has built up about $6 billion in debts through trying to build these reactors, and it might just be too big of an egg for Toshiba to swallow. So what started out as Westinghouse declaring bankruptcy last year has now potentially expanded into Toshiba potentially declaring bankruptcy as the parent corporation now, just a month later. And there are some serious questions about whether the Japanese government is going to have to, you know, is going to intercede in the same way that the U.S. government interceded in bailing out the auto companies 10 or 8 years ago. That may be the same sort of a thing happening with Toshiba.
Bloomberg reported just recently that Trump officials see a new national security issue in this Toshiba Westinghouse bankruptcy. The failure is so big and so dangerous that it's involved hurried meetings with Energy Secretary Rick Perry, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. It sounds like an all-hands-on-deck emergency for the White House. Why are they concerned?
Well, I would leave it to the national security establishment to figure out whether there are real national security implications to Westinghouse going bankrupt. I think what they're most concerned about is whether China is going to step in and try to buy Westinghouse to essentially support its own nuclear ventures and the completion of its own reactors. But if there's national security information that the Westinghouse possesses, then they might be able to block China from acquiring the company. Although there's already been a ton of technology transfer from the U.S. to China for these nuclear power projects that's already taken place. And China's already developed its own new reactor designs based on essentially copycatting the Westinghouse reactors. So, you know, if there are real national security implications to information that Westinghouse might have about nuclear science or technology, then they should just stop that acquisition from taking place if it comes up and let Westinghouse just go bankrupt and die.
Wow. Well, suppose the American government doesn't end up paying for the mistakes of this private corporation and to finish these reactors. Who will eat all the cost overruns or the money spent on reactors that might never even open?
Well, that's a little bit to be decided. One of the factors that's in play is a financing provision that was created in the 2005 energy law, whereby the U.S. government offered up to $18 billion in taxpayer-guaranteed loans for the construction of these reactors. The two reactors that are being built in Georgia have received about $8.3 billion in this taxpayer financing, essentially what's called a loan guarantee that would allow, if the venture goes bankrupt or the company that owns the reactors isn't able to pay the loans, then essentially taxpayers would absorb that loss. Essentially, the loan would be forgiven, and taxpayers would have coughed up $8 billion without getting it repaid. The project in South Carolina actually didn't take advantage of that financing, so there's no taxpayer loans from the U.S. federal government in place. But in both states, what's really making both of these projects happen are state legislation that's called construction work in progress. And anybody who – you should watch out for these kind of provisions in your own states, because what they essentially do is authorize the utilities to bill customers for power plants that are being built but aren't operational. And so, in effect, something like up to 20% of the electricity bills that people in South Carolina are paying right now are for construction costs of these two reactors that are still only about 30% complete. You know, there's billions of dollars more to be spent on these things. And the same thing is happening in Georgia.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg. You wrote something called Too Big to Bail Out: The Economic Costs of a National Nuclear Power Subsidy. Tim Judson, tell us about some of the ways the public is paying big private corporations these hidden subsidies for nuclear energy.
Sure. Well, the nuclear power companies have been going around the country the last couple of years talking about how there's an unlevel playing field where natural gas prices are cheap because of fracking, and renewable energy is unfairly subsidized so that people can sell wind and solar for cheaper than what nuclear plants can pay. The reality is, you know, that this is really a self-serving argument. Nuclear power has been one of the most heavily subsidized industries in the country for decades. And the current nuclear power plants were built with massive subsidies from federal and state governments. And they also include things that are sort of non-subsidy subsidies, like, for instance, the fact that nuclear power companies don't need to obtain private insurance to cover the cost of a nuclear meltdown, like happened at Three Mile Island or Fukushima. Essentially, the taxpayers are insuring those nuclear plants against accidents by essentially limiting the industry's liability, and taxpayers could end up paying for hundreds of billions of dollars in the case of a nuclear accident. Taxpayers are also ultimately going to be responsible for managing the nuclear waste that nuclear power plants generate for, you know, that's toxic for hundreds of thousands of years. And there's also, you know, other major costs like the cleanup of uranium mining sites where, you know, we have very lax environmental laws regulating uranium mining, and we have 15,000 abandoned uranium mine sites across the country that have never been cleaned up, and there's no provision yet for that to happen. And most of those uranium mines are in Native American communities. So there's a major environmental justice issues all around in this. These are all ways in which current nuclear power plants are subsidized, and a lot of the costs are being borne by the public and by the environment. But now, with these current reactors all becoming old, the average age of a nuclear power plant in the U.S. is 36 years, and more than half of them are older than 40 years. So these reactors were only licensed and expected to run for 40 years originally. And that was why the U.S. government, you know, made a point of trying to inspire the nuclear renaissance to start building new reactors to replace the old ones. Well, with the failure of the nuclear renaissance and the fact that building new nuclear reactors is not possible or desirable in the U.S. right now, the industry is trying to keep these old reactors going. The problem that they're having is that the cost of operating old nuclear reactors is skyrocketing because of the amount of maintenance that they require and the very high expenses for components and doing this kind of maintenance work on these old plants. And so, you know, while energy prices have gone down, while demand for electricity has gone down because of energy efficiency improvements, while renewable energy is growing at an increasingly fast rate because of the improving economics of renewables, the economics of nuclear power are going down the toilet. So now the industry has been pushing for more subsidies and bailouts for these old reactors, new subsidies for old reactors. And they started proposing these subsidies in 2014. And, you know, people at the state level were very effective at stopping them for those first 2 years. Unfortunately, the industry was able to get Governor Cuomo in New York to ram through a bailout of astronomical proportions last year, $7.6 billion for four aging reactors. And Illinois followed suit on the heels of that, so that essentially, you know, two states are now on deck to subsidize old reactors to the tune of $10 billion. And they're taking these proposals to other states where there's now bills, you know, potentially being in play in Connecticut, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, and potentially other states to come. This is an issue that's of, you know, sort of massive, you know, national implications. And what's really outrageous about it is these same reactors were bailed out 20 years ago to the tune of $80 billion on their bad debts for building these nukes. And the idea was that by bailing them out 20 years ago, we were supposed to be free of consumers bearing the risk of nuclear power, the economic risks of nuclear power going forward. And here we are 20 years later, as the industry is on the verge of going out of business, with another round of bailouts that could essentially divert billions and billions of dollars away from clean energy investment into propping up old nukes.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Tim Judson from the American nonprofit watchdog called NIRS. And we're talking about the huge bankruptcy of Westinghouse Electric, the nuclear power subsidiary of the Toshiba Corporation. Well, Tim, the Toshiba Corporation isn't alone drowning in nuclear debt. What is the situation with the French nuclear power builder Areva?
Sure. Areva is, like Westinghouse, one of the flagship nuclear corporations in the world. Areva is a state-owned corporation, about 80 to 90% state-owned by the government of France, alongside Électricité de France, which is the French nuclear utility, which operates nuclear power plants. Areva has been sort of the contractor arm of the industry in France that designs and builds reactors, that mines and processes uranium, that reprocesses and manages nuclear waste and that sort of thing. They're also active in the U.S. and nuclear projects here as well. So Areva was, like Westinghouse, one of the flagship companies that was supposed to start this nuclear renaissance with new reactor designs that were supposed to be safer and more economical. And Areva actually went down the tubes faster than Westinghouse did. So Areva has been building two new reactors in China, two new reactors in Europe. They had proposed a few new reactors in the U.S. Again, like Westinghouse, all of those projects are billions of dollars above budget, years behind schedule, even further behind than the Westinghouse reactors are so far. And so Areva essentially went bankrupt last year, and essentially the company has been carved up to where EDF is now, Électricité de France has now absorbed some parts of Areva's company, and then other parts of Areva are essentially being left to go fallow. And so what you have right now between Areva and Westinghouse, these are the only two corporations in the world that have been able to commercialize nuclear reactor designs that have actually been able to market and export new reactors and start building them. Both of these companies are going down the tubes because of what a failure building new nukes has become. And there's no one else on deck that's proved, you know, any other nuclear corporation in the world that's even proved able to get as far along as they have. So what's happening in nuclear power right now is sort of like if all of the major car companies went out of business and you couldn't buy any new cars. That is actually happening to nuclear power right now, where every company that has actually been manufacturing new reactors is on the verge of going out of business.
What about the British plans to build a new reactor? Is that going ahead even as wind, solar, and gas are way, way cheaper?
Well, what's happening in the UK is sort of on the tail end of all this. So there's a project called Hinkley Point C, which is a project to build two new reactors at an existing site in England. And so that was a project where Areva was contracted to build two of these new reactors like those that are under construction in Europe and China. The feasibility of that project has been incredibly bad, just, you know, from the start. And the projected cost of building it has varied from between $30 billion and $40 billion for two of these reactors. And in fact, you know, until the new government was elected in the UK last year, there were expectations that Hinkley Point was going to go down the tubes, in part because of all the problems that are facing Areva and the French nuclear industry and their ability to finance the project, but also because of the improving economics of renewables and the fast rate of growth of solar and wind in the UK. The Theresa May government has essentially decided that they are going to prioritize nuclear over renewables, and the Areva board of directors and the EDF board of directors have decided that they can't afford to let this project go down the tubes yet. And so they've essentially created some incredible measures to be able to make Hinkley Point move forward, including a 30-year commitment by ratepayers in the United Kingdom to buy this electricity at twice the market rate of electricity in the UK right now. You know, it's questionable whether that project is ever going to be completed. They haven't really begun construction yet. And so there's at least, you know, probably, you know, 5 to 10 years, you know, along the way for Hinkley Point to, you know, to go belly up in the same way that the projects in the U.S. seem to be.
You know, in my opinion, this has never been a business. It's always been a kind of a scam, as I said at the beginning of this program, to suck money out of the taxpayer and some executives make big money, but the public ends up poorer in the future. Now, history is quite clear that the nuclear power industry was developed to keep materials and skills flowing into the nuclear weapons program. Does the Pentagon still need civilian nuclear power?
Well, I mean, it depends on what you think of the government's policy on nuclear weapons. You know, if we were really committed to a policy of disarmament in this country and, you know, in the phase out of nuclear weapons, then there's not much argument for, you know, for keeping a whole another side industry going in order to provide the technology and expertise necessary to do that. But what some British researchers did last year was they actually did a study to figure out why the British government was so committed to this Hinkley Point project. And they did surveys with policymakers and people in the industry, and the paper that they published concluded that the real thing that was driving the government's commitment to new nuclear power plants in the UK was wanting to be able to have the technical expertise and the industrial capacity to keep their nuclear submarine weapons program going. And so I think that probably the same is true in the U.S., that there's, you know, a deep institutional commitment within the federal government. The Department of Energy's primary business is managing the nuclear weapons complex, and there are now proposals to fund the revitalization and development of our nuclear weapons program to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars over the next several years. And so I think that there's probably the same dynamic is in play here.
As you know, President Obama was friendly towards nuclear power. Some say he got campaign money from the industry. What have you heard about Donald Trump's relationship with the nuclear power industry?
Well, there's not much to be said about his past relationship. I mean, he's made favorable statements about nuclear power in the past, and he's certainly made some very troubling comments about nuclear weapons and our nuclear weapons program that suggests that he is very supportive of improving and increasing our nuclear arsenal. And so that's one of the concerns that we would have, is that a Trump administration, with its commitment to dirty energy and to propping up dirty energy industries like coal and natural gas, that they could view nuclear in the same way, as well as see it having a national security interest in propping up nuclear power. It would be a terrible mistake to do that.
Well, now that America, France, and the UK, and many others are stuck with this nuclear power mess, is there any sane plan to get out of it?
Well, there's no plan by the U.S. government to get out of it. In fact, that's one of the things that we've been trying to bring to people's attention in questioning these bailouts that have been going on, is that essentially the energy industry, and from the federal government down to state regulatory agencies and policymakers, and in the very communities that these power plants are in, have been whistling past the graveyard on what's happening with nuclear power. We had a meeting with the Governor Cuomo's administration in New York over 3 years ago to inform them that the economics of these nuclear power plants in New York were going down the tubes, and that, in fact, these reactors might close early. And it was relevant because the state was developing its next six-year energy plan, and we thought that they should be aware of it. They're planning on these nukes being in operation, that they needed to reevaluate that. And they should also be prepared for the industry to start coming to them for subsidies in order to keep these plants profitable. We were virtually laughed out of the room with the idea that the Governor Cuomo, who was trying to build a reputation as an advocate for clean energy and was working to shut down the Indian Point nuclear power plant near New York City, that he would ever consider subsidizing nuclear power. Well, what happened just 2 years later was that the governor was not only going along with a bailout, but he was actively pushing it. And what was really motivating that going on was essentially the industry making, really serious threats to close nuclear power plants immediately, like within a matter of months, and potentially facing the governor facing a political problem with job losses in parts of the state where he's politically vulnerable. And what we see across from whether it's in New York or Illinois or these other states, what's driving the push for bailouts is that states have been asleep at the wheel, not paying attention to what's going on with nuclear power, assuming that these plants are always going to be cheap and they're always going to be there. And then companies like Exelon and Entergy coming forward with threats to close plants in a matter of months and not knowing what to do politically about the loss of jobs and property taxes and local economic impact. I mean, there needs to be a plan, and I think there are, organizations like ours that are working on helping states develop plans to deal with reactor closures. But in terms of the policymaker level, at the states and at the federal level, there's been a complete unwillingness to actually deal with this problem. And we know what's happening with coal. Coal plants have been closing over the last several years. It's a well-understood trend that the coal is on its way out. People have not anticipated that happening with nuclear, and it's really caught policymakers by surprise.
Well, let's say there is a major nuclear accident in the United States, heaven forbid. The public demands an immediate shutdown of all nuclear plants. Do the lights go out, or are there enough other sources of power that we could cope somehow?
Sure. I mean, one of the problems that the nuclear industry is having in the U.S. is that we actually have an oversupply of electricity generation capacity. The competition to sell electricity on the markets is so stiff because there's such a huge supply that prices have gone down significantly. I mean, it's always a local question whether if a particular power plant shuts down, whether you need to take some measures to compensate for it. But, on a national basis, I think you can look to Japan and see what's happened there to get a clear sense of it. Japan was more dependent on nuclear power than the U.S. is before the Fukushima accidents. And essentially overnight, Japan went from 30% nuclear power to zero, and effectively has been at zero for the last 2.5 years. And the lights haven't gone off in Japan. They have struggled and managed to keep the lights on through things like energy efficiency and energy conservation. But, renewables are growing at a pretty stiff clip. And what you see, the interesting story about Japan versus a country like Germany, where they're planning a planned nuclear phase out, is that in Japan, the nukes went off overnight, but the utilities have billions and billions of dollars invested in these plants, and they don't want to have to write them off and declare bankruptcy. And so the utilities have been getting in the way of what's the obvious solution to Japan's energy problem, which is that they should be investing in wind and solar and energy efficiency dramatically. But the utilities have been getting in the way of that and blocking renewable energy politically in Japan. The same problem could happen in the U.S. The U.S. public could turn, against nuclear power if there's another accident. and demand that the reactors be shut down. But very powerful energy corporations could still interfere with having a plan for alternatives.
For a couple of decades, you and I have been fighting off craven nuclear promoters like Bjorn Lomborg and the Breakthrough Institute, and well-meaning Greens like James Hansen and Mark Linus. We said the nuclear industry is super dangerous, badly regulated, bound for bankruptcy. Now that's all come to pass, but it doesn't really feel like a win. People are saddled with risky rundown reactors and hundreds of billions more public debt. Tim Judson, is this a case where nobody wins?
Well, I mean, the path to winning is clear. In a sense, you know, the way that the energy industry and the utilities in particular have managed to stall progress on the clean energy transition for decades has been by pitting consumers and environmentalists and labor against one another, by preventing the clean energy alternatives from coming to the fore, and by making the kind of political threats about job losses and everything else and skyrocketing energy prices and blackouts and that sort of thing, you know, for far too long. And so I think the propaganda that the energy industry has created for decades makes it seem like there's a zero sum situation. We've got to accept, you know, environmental pollution, nuclear catastrophe risks if we want to have our lights on and our energy cheap. The opposite is true now. I mean, you know, the advances that have been made in energy efficiency and renewables and now new technologies like energy storage and smart grids and smart energy management mean that we're actually on the cusp of being able to completely transform our energy system over the next 10 to 20 years from one that's based on these dirty centralized power plants that are causing climate change and, you know, and nuclear waste to a completely clean energy system that could actually rebuild our economy and save the planet. So the reality is just that, you know, it's an inconvenient truth for the energy industry that the solutions are here.
Give us a brief snapshot of your group, the Nuclear Information Resource Service. What is it?
Sure. So we're an environmental group that was founded in 1978 to essentially be the sort of the nationwide information center and networking hub for grassroots activists across the country who are concerned about nuclear power and radioactive waste. So we have a small staff, but we work nationally supporting, you know, groups at the state and local level to be informed and engaged on nuclear issues and to run national campaigns when necessary, to be able to bring about the end of nuclear power and, you know, and to ensure that communities aren't contaminated with radioactive waste.
We've been talking with Tim Judson. He's the executive director of the Nuclear Information Resource Service, or NIRS. You can find them at nirs.org. You can also find more links and news stories about the Toshiba Westinghouse bankruptcy in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.